Hello everyone, I see that people are still joining, so let's wait.
So we have a follow-up show with Emily right after this.
Sorry, can you mute?
With Olivia, somewhere around here. And then the study with Katie. My day is so busy to have this, and then Emily.
Hello, hi, sorry, can you mute?
You muted.
Then I have a cut.
Adia, please mute. Thank you.
Okay, hi everyone, can I be heard? Lisa from MIT here. Yes, great, okay, thank you. I see that people... Sorry, if you're not talking, if you don't want to say anything, please mute. Great. I see that people are still joining, so we are waiting an extra few more minutes before we start.
Halo, halo, słuchaj, widziałem, że się podłączyłeś. Musisz kliknąć na to JRPC dwa razy. Tak, wiesz.
Right, everyone. May I ask who Sharon of Ainur is, please? Sorry. No, I was asking if you could tell us who you are. Okay, I think we are ready to start. Actually, I see more people. Okay, so we are broadcasting our screen from MIT. I see 72 viewers. The link is in the chat, and you also have the link to the DCC talk. Okay, so we start now. This is another talk related to the event. As have you seen from the email that Laura sent around, we will have a couple of more talks in the upcoming weeks. So today Matt is going to talk about how we know that the event was not an injection. So please, if you have questions, just type in the chat. I will keep an eye at the chat during this talk. Okay, so we start.
Hi, hello everybody. Let me adjust the microphone here. There are page numbers on these things in the upper right, so I'm on page 2 for anyone who doesn't have screen operating. So I guess many of you had the same experience I did, which is you woke up early in the morning, September 14th, and heard that we had something interesting in the data, and you probably immediately assumed that this was an injection, either intentional, blind, gone wrong, software bug, something like that. And since then, I think, you know, we've all been asking ourselves, how could this signal, which appears so perfect, have appeared and so loud, have appeared in the data so early in the run, and it all seems a bit improbable. So I think it's reasonable for people to ask if this was some sort of injection, was it somehow faked? And so I want to start by just sort of talking about how injections are normally done and what I mean by injections in the signal for anyone who isn't aware of the various injection mechanisms that we normally use. So on page 3, the first sort of thing I think, and I'm guessing most of the audience are people who look at the data, so mostly people who are looking at HT or one way or another doing data analysis, and you're probably all familiar with software injections. And this is something that I think is done very regularly. We add some strain to the HFT, to the strain channel, after it's recorded, and use this for testing analysis pipelines. Obviously, this addition doesn't add or doesn't appear in the raw frames or in data, which is earlier in the chain. So if we want to test the full chain of data flow throughout LIGO, we need to do what are called hardware injections. And in this case, since we want to go really from the beginning to the end, we simulate our gravitational wave signal by pushing on one of the mirrors in the interferometer. And this is a way of mimicking a gravitational wave strain really from the beginning to the end of our pipelines. So hardware injections appear in many channels, and they're actually put in through the digital system. So hardware is a bit of a misnomer. They really are digital injections, but made very early in the chain. And they're hardware in the sense that they do actually affect the hardware, and we do really move some optics around. And then the third kind of injection, or standard injection, is what's called a blind injection. A blind injection is really just a hardware injection, but it's done in a way that uses off-limits channels, so that if you're playing by the rules of the game, then you don't know this happened, and you're blind to this. And that is a way of testing not only the software part of our analysis, but also the human part of the analysis. So these are our three standard injection mechanisms. So of course, early in the morning on the 14th, my best guess was that this was a hardware injection, which had, we were in the process of testing these things, so maybe something had just gone wrong, and that's what it was. And we'll see as we go along that's not really the case. So it was actually the first thing that I think everyone thought, and it was checked quickly to see whether or not this was a standard hardware injection, one of the either blind injection or hardware injection, but something which went in through the usual mechanisms that we have for doing this. It turns out that it was discovered very quickly this was not a standard injection. And on thinking about it a little bit more clearly, it's also true that we weren't really even in a position to make these hardware injections. We were still getting our software right and getting the filters right and whatnot. So if we say this isn't a normal injection, they're pretty easy to rule out, then we have to ask ourselves what the abnormal injections might be. So now I'm on page 5. I call these rogue injections. So a rogue injection is something where I want to include both intentional and accidental effects, but something where an injection is added to the data one way or another, such that we get a fake signal to appear in HFT, but not in the way that's reported typically. And usually, when we think about this, we're thinking about something malicious, where someone's intentionally trying to fool us. But I include here also kind of all sorts of accidental things, maybe some strange bug in the front-end software or whatever that would cause this. There's some echo. I think someone has their mic open out there. Okay, so the first type that I'll consider is something I've called frame spoofing. And maybe everyone who's worked with Unix systems knows that it's not all that hard. You have root access to change a file, change all the access times, and if you're really clever, you can even erase the tracks that you're over there by changing appropriate log files on the computer. So one could imagine that that as soon as the frames from the interferometers hit a disk somewhere, someone would maliciously modify them by adding something to the strain channel and then change the modification dates back to make it look like nothing happened. So this would be a frame spoof. The second class of rogue injections I'll consider here are what I call double blind injections. So it's something where someone has done a blind injection, which is even blinder in the sense that it's not recorded in the usual way that blind injections are recorded. And in here, as sort of a subclass, I've included these things, which I call Easter egg hacks. And that's something where the digital control system has somehow been modified to make it so that these double blind injections are harder to follow up on. And I'll talk a little bit about those as well. And then a third broad class of injections would be some sort of analog hack. So here I'm thinking of it from the point of view of someone who maybe doesn't know the software system all that well, but they know the hardware quite well, and has access, physical access to the instrument. Maybe there's something you could do to add some malicious piece of hardware to the instruments and cause signals to appear in the output in a way similar to a hardware injection, but not going through the digital system, so a lower level than that. So I'll talk about each of these three sort of classes of hacks. So the first thing I have to get to is really how the strain signal gets from the interferometers to your computer. Again, I'm assuming most of the people on the line look at the data as it comes out the end of the pipeline, not the end of your analysis pipeline, but the end of the interferometer storage and data analysis side. So the way the strain gets to your computer is it starts out in the interferometer somewhere at one of the sites and goes probably to Caltech, and then from Caltech it's distributed to many other people for analysis. And the first thing that comes to mind if you want to inject something into the signal is that you probably ought to get to it as early in this process as you can. If you wait for frames to be distributed to many different locations, it seems like you'll have a monumental task to try to hack all of those and retroactively change them all to be the same. So I think we can start by assuming that whatever malicious injection might have happened, it must have happened somewhere fairly early in the chain. So moving on to page 7, I'm just going to zoom into what happens at the sites. So sort of the bubbles on the previous page on the far left-hand side, I'll go look inside of one of those. And in a sort of cartoon-ish fashion, I've represented the pieces of the chain the signal flows through. So the first piece is the interferometer, and here we're taking some gravitational wave strain and printing it on the light, the laser field. That gets read out by some photodetectors, goes through a digital control system, which is represented by this old picture of a Cray computer, and that goes to some data storage, so somewhere we get frame files written. So that's my bank of disks on the right-hand side at the bottom. So this is sort of the conceptual flow of information from the interferometer into frame files, which are then used for analysis and distributed. So on to page 8, frame spoofing is really the idea of saying, let's get into the data storage end. So the last part in this chain before the data gets spread out everywhere, and try to modify those files on disk. And you could imagine that if that was done properly, we would sort of never know. If you got to the frames that represent the Hanford data and the frames that represent the Louisiana data and added something to strain in both of them, and then they got spread out for analysis, maybe that would be good enough. So I have my frame spoofing hacker is this guy here with the hoodie and looking very threatening. He's going to see if he can hack into our data storage. And the first thing that our hacker would discover is that the system is much more complicated than you might imagine. So it's not a matter of finding one frame file sitting on a disk somewhere in a directory and adding something to the strain channel. The data is distributed from the digital control system over the network to multiple different frame writers, and those are being written to redundant disk arrays. And it's also distributed through the frame broadcaster more broadly. So it goes to another set of disk arrays at the observatories, and it goes also to Caltech. This means that if you wanted to somehow modify the frames, if you wanted to do this kind of a frame spoof attack, you would need to find many different redundant copies and modify them all. In addition to that, we have checksums which are made and cross-checked between all of the various copies. And those checksums are made, you know, essentially instantaneously after the frames arrive on the disk, so very quickly. And then there's a process which goes and, you know, cross-checks the checksums from the various different repositories. So this hack would mean that you'd really need to break into multiple computers at both observatories and at Caltech, and you'd need to know the internals of the system well enough to cover up not just your login and the timestamps on the files that you've modified, but also all of the relevant cross-check data, so the checksums which are produced and stored elsewhere. But it becomes a fairly large task. I'll move on to page 11 in my slides. You need to really go through and get all of these various frames modified, and I think that Greg Mendel told me that we don't even have anybody who has the right root permissions to do all of these modifications. So you need to have a hacker with very broad access.
Okay, Matt, I see that there are a couple of questions, so maybe we can
Sure. Stop
now. So Bruce is asking, is there anything that has compared these files for the different stored frame file?
So I know that Greg is answering the question there. Greg has, you know, compares the checksums and the M5 sums and MD5 sums. So Greg, if you want to open your mic and answer this, that would be fine. I think the answer is that these cross checks have been made and are always made.
Well, I'd say they're not. LDR, as Bruce is saying, automatically makes them when they get transferred from LDAS at one site to some other site. But between CDS and LDAS, that was a check I did by hand. It's not normally, I mean, we create the MD5 something as we copy the data over from CDS to LDAS and record that. And it gets recorded in a couple, it gets recorded by some LDAS scripts and by LDR. But we aren't, in some sense, when we copy it, we check right then that we got the right data. But we don't have anything recording on CDS side of things to compare with normally. So I did that check by hand.
Okay, thanks.
Wait a second, there are many more questions. So how many people have root access to these computer systems?
Greg, do you want to take that one?
So the admins for each of the different systems have root access, and maybe only at their site, though I would say LDAS admins probably have some kind of access at the different LDAS sites within the lab, so LHO, LLO, and Caltech. But for example, I don't think anyone has, there's also the DMT disk here involved, and there's a CDS disk. I don't think any one person has root access to the file systems in the diagram for CDS, DMT, and LDAS, all of which had the data on it. Of course, a hacker might hack in and get root access, but no one admin, I think, can log into all of those different systems at both observatories.
Okay, thanks, Greg. Other questions here? We're looking at the chat on this side.
Okay, so I see Stuart.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that in this model, I think the hack has to be further upstream before the frames are written to disk, because the low latency pipelines, which don't use the frames written by CDS, detected the signal in low latency. They get that data via the GDS network, which is all on the network before any files go to disk.
Yeah, that's the very bottom. There should maybe a red circle on the very bottom thing, the DMT net router sending things down to Caltech.
So the common mode, the first common mode to hack, if one were to do this, would be the data concentrator, which is common to CDS and GDS, but before the data is written to frames.
Right, so I will get into this in my sort of the next section, and that's under my Easter eggs hacks. But yeah, certainly, but sort of the conclusion from this, you know, this piece of the analysis and looking at where vulnerabilities are is that this does not really look like a vulnerability, and you'd probably need to move upstream.
Okay, there is another question. So, what precautions were taken to ensure that data do not get corrupted later?
I think the short answer has to be that they would all have to be corrupted in the same way, and there are many different copies.
Right. Can the frame builders do the injection at a predetermined future date?
The frame writers, frame broadcasters. I don't think any of that, certainly none is designed to do that. And I'm pretty sure that if we let Rolf speak to this, he can give a clear answer. That code has all been checked. Rolf, do you want to add anything? Is Rolf online? If not Rolf, then Dave, Barker, or Keith.
This is Keith. Yes, when we look at all the code, once, if you looked at the thing, we checked when the code been changed, and the same code executable had been running for weeks, or for a week or two. And so no one went in and changed the code, and we checked it against what it was built against. And we certainly are looking at the code, but we haven't found any. All that code is out of the SVN repository. We look at the code. We'll have a little further, meaning it's part of our sort of code review. But there was no one went and put one in and took it out.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I think there is a last question. Has someone spoofed a single frame as a proof of concept to list all the steps that are required or to show that it's impossible?
In some sense, Albert, I think that's, the easiest part of that would be just to say that changing a single frame is kind of like doing a software injection. But if I get to the next slide, you'll see why it's not that easy.
Okay, and then, sorry, there is still another one. Is the actual low latency data the low latency pipelines used to detect stored anywhere? Or is it lost?
Well, for this event, we did. The low latency data is written out in several different places, actually, different copies of it, and it gets aggregated. So some of those copies go to disk and get aggregated into the aggregate HOT. So we do store all of the low latency data in aggregate HOT. But also, in this case, we stored exactly what went down that low latency pipeline, which is another copy of it that normally shows up in shared memory for 300 seconds. But we copy that onto some scratch disk for the last week, but this time we actually archived those exact frames as well, which are just identical to all the... So actually DMT produces three HOT data in three different places and all. Actually I've got all three of those stored away somewhere, but the one of them goes into aggregation and the other one we... in this case, archived around the day of the event.
Okay.
And they all agree with each other. They're all the identical data in all of them.
Okay, great.
Any other questions? I should.
Yeah, I suggest we move on at this point. I think we...
All right, I will keep going here. I think that the next point is sort of relevant to these, but the conclusion from this is that it would be extremely challenging to really spoof this data after it leaves CDS and once it gets into LDAS, but just because of how quickly it's distributed and how widely it's distributed, and those things have been checked. So thanks to Greg for speaking here, but also for writing me lengthy emails about this. And I should say, I didn't mention at the beginning, there's a little footnote on one of the slides that says the references for all of the things I'm presenting here on the last slide. And that includes a large number of things that have been put in the log and some documents written about this. And this includes the email that Greg wrote to me about exactly this topic. So anyone who wants to go back and pore through the event logs can find all of this in some excruciating detail. All right, so I'll move on to slide 12. I think that it's easy for people to imagine that if you manage to pull off this frame spoof, which I think is highly unlikely, but if you did manage to pull it off, what would you need to do? And it's easy to think that you just need to change the strain channel, but it turns out that if you really wanted to replace all of the frames with all the relevant information, you'd have a much larger task. So on page 13, you see a diagram of the CDS system and all of the different ways in which the strain signal, which I'll refer to as DARM, because that's what I'm used to referring to it as, that's the differential arm signal, all the ways in which DARM is recorded. So the interferometer has a control system which keeps it on the operating point, and that control system has a servo loop, and as the gravitational wave strain signal appears on our photodetectors, it then flows through this servo system.
Refresh the page.
I think they were referring to Rainer.
Huh?
I think they were trying to refresh to Rainer, not
plus.
The other side. The other side? Okay.
Okay, sorry to interrupt.
All right, so this is a piece of work that I did where I went through and looked at where does our signal go after it appears in the photodetectors. I think that what people are used to seeing is the version which exits the calibration front end as h of t. But before it appears as h of t, that signal is recorded just as what comes out of the photodetectors and in through the analog digital converters. And then it's recorded something like 30 times. I don't think I followed down every possible location, but I did follow up 32 locations in which the signal is recorded. Each with slightly different gain factors, different filters are applied, so the frequency content is somewhat different in each of these things. And in order to get all of these versions right, you need to essentially simulate the front-end computer processing. So you need to do a time-domain filtering of the signal as it comes out of the photodetectors and then propagate it through the digital system. This is a fairly lengthy process, and I don't think the software really existed to do this, though it certainly could have existed somewhere. But I don't think anyone had done this before the event, and it requires some fairly in-depth knowledge of the CDS system to get all the various gain factors right. And even the filters that are present in here change fairly regularly, and they're different between the observatories. So if you wanted to do a frame spoof and replace the low-level frames with something that would be believable, you would need to go through and actually simulate the front-end system and calculate all of these signals properly. This even includes, at the end of the chain, so on the far right, we have a number of monitors, and those are analog monitor channels that are then digitized again, which show what was sent to the various actuators. And the L2 monitors in particular show clearly the signals which flow through the system after they've gone out of our digital analog converters and then been read back in. So again, in order to get that signal right, you end up looking at some schematics for pieces of electronics. All of this is in the DCC, but if you don't know what you're doing, it's hard for me to believe that anyone could find it. In fact, I had to go make phone calls to figure out what those transfer functions are. So the process of frame spoofing is non-trivial from the security of the computer and data side. It's also non-trivial from the side of what exactly you would need to do, even if you had access to all of the right computers. So on slide 14, I think that concludes the frame spoof. It seems overly challenging. It goes to epsilon squared kind of thing. It's a very, very tricky in at least a couple of different ways. So from there, I think we have to move upstream, try to find some other place to put in a signal. And so this brings me to the double-blind injections. And one could reasonably ask, did something go wrong in our injection mechanism? Which caused the signal to appear in both interferometers. And I've heard people say something like, you know, maybe it was a blind injection. How do we ever know? If it didn't end up in the envelope, then, you know, the record of it would somehow forever be lost to history. And unfortunately, that's not true. So let me go through this upstream injections of various sorts. So my injector is the anonymous guy with a little plus symbol, because he's going to try to add something. And again, I start with kind of the cartoon version. I do this throughout this talk because I discovered that usually my knowledge of some system that I don't work on is kind of cartoonish like this. And then as I would dig in, for instance, to the LDAS system with Greg's help, and to the CDS system with the help of Rolf and Dave and Keith, that the system is actually much more complicated than you think. So you start with some sort of cartoon idea of what's going on, and it seems like it might be easy to make some injection. If we go back to the figure of what's really going on inside the CDS computer, it's more complicated. So I show anonymous hacker here injecting a signal in the place where our hardware injections usually happen, which is right after the DARM filter bank and before they get sent to the suspensions. And you know, the idea would be that someone got in and made an injection like this, but not using any of the channels that we usually associate with injections. So somehow it's the double blind means they didn't use the blind injection channel, but they used some other mystery channel that none of us remember the existence of. So the analysis I was doing, we talked about briefly before, was one in which I tried to eliminate any sort of injection anywhere in the digital system. And you can do this by taking the signals at the input of the system and propagating them all the way through the digital system to the output, and then checking against what was recorded all the way along the way and making sure that it makes sense. So this is kind of the cross-check that ensures that the frame spoof couldn't have worked if they didn't get everything done right. It also ensures that you can't inject something because the signals at the end won't match if I add something in the middle. So let me show some plots to kind of demonstrate how this works. That's slide 18. So the little suns, actually let me go back to slide 17. All of the little stars or little sun-looking symbols are places where the data is recorded. And the little red suns to the right-hand side are places where the data is recorded in quadruplicate. So there are four copies, each of them occasionally slightly different. To make it interesting, but basically we have four copies on each of those, and that's how I end up with 30-some signals. So back to slide 18, I show a few example signals of what's being recorded. So the first little plot on the left is showing the signal that comes out of the photodetectors, and then I've added them together to get a single signal. So this is the DARM signal, or the thing which becomes H of T. And I'm doing this at a time in which we had an injection into the system. So it was October 2nd, I think, sometime later after the event. So in the first plot, you see that you really have just this orange curve, and there's kind of nothing else there. In the second plot, you see that you have something orange and something blue, and that blue is the addition of a signal which causes the thing I calculate from the photodetectors, which is orange, to be different. So let me say that again. If I take the signals I observe at the beginning from PDA and PDB and then calculate what I should get all the way along the chain, those are the orange curves in each of these plots. Whereas the blue curves in each of these plots are what's actually recorded. And from this you can see that as soon as something is added, the expected signal doesn't match the recorded signal anymore. So the injection in the digital system is quite obvious. And if I go all the way to the end of the chain, so the plots on the far right are the ones which are at the outputs, the digital to analog converters, and monitor those signals and compare them what I calculate from the very beginning of the chain, I can actually rule out an injection anywhere in between. So the objective of this analysis was really just that, and it tells us that not only did an injection not happen in the standard location, there was no injection anywhere in the digital system. Because the signals which came out of the digital analog converters are what you expect from what came in analog to digital converters. So the slide 19 shows the same set of plots, but done at the time of the event. And you can see there's really no blue to be found anywhere in here. And that's just because the blue is sitting under the orange everywhere. It just says that we got what we expected. And again, there's no way that this includes any sort of blind injection. The blind injections are not special in the sense they're not hidden in any complicated way. A blind injection would appear like any other injection in this analysis.
So there is only one question. If the rogue injection used less than perfect calibration between the observatories, can the difference be detected?
So for this particular kind of analysis that I did here, I don't really care about the coincidence between the detectors. Anything which is injected should show up. And of course, I looked at the signals from both Hanford and Livingston, and both of them give the same result. That is, a signal propagated through the chain without any sort of addition.
Could anyone get light into the photodiodes, say through the back of a mirror? Very hard.
Yeah, I will get to that in the next section of analog hacks. And if I don't respond precisely to your question, let me know. But I think the short answer is no. That all happens in a vacuum system. It's all shrouded with black glass. You would need to get on a spacesuit and go crawl around the vacuum system somehow.
Could a rogue front-end model insert HFT at the PDADC channels?
I will get to this question by Keith Riles in a couple slides. Let me do a couple of examples of how these things could go, and then I'll answer some more of these questions.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, so on slide 20, I show the first thing that comes to mind. Once we've ruled out anything which could be injected in the darn loop in the usual way, you'd say, okay, well, maybe someone injected something in some other channel somewhere in the system, which couples to DARM, and that injection then fools us because it doesn't appear in the DARM signal chain. I'll use the photon calibrator, which is called PCAL, as my canonical example of this, but there are other channels that you can imagine doing this in. To reassure you, they've all been checked as well as PCAL. Everything has been checked. But let me just use PCAL as my standard example because it's the most obvious one. The photon calibrator is something we use to calibrate the instrument, and it's a way to directly apply a force to the mirror. It's kind of an appealing thing because it's somewhat separate from the DARM signal chain. So this looks like maybe a way to get around this check and make an injection. So I'm on slide 21. We've made injections now with PCAL to see how this works. And it does work in the sense that you can make injections through the photon calibrator. But of course, when you do that, that injection shows up in some auxiliary channel, something which is monitoring that actuator. And then all of our actuators have the signals which are sent to them recorded, usually in multiple fashions. So for the various actuators on the mirrors, there are the monitors I talked about before. For the photon calibrator, we have two photodiodes, and we know what we sent to the modulator, as we know what we sent to the photon calibrator, and then we also record what came out of it in two different ways. And if you go back and look at these things at the time of an injection, you can see that the signal is quite clear. So the plot in the lower left is an October 8th injection made with the PCAL. And the blue kind of hash in the background is showing calibration lines, which usually appear in the Y-arm PCAL. And the orange sitting on top of that is showing the injection which happened in the X-arm PCAL. And again, the signal is not small. In fact, it requires a significant fraction of the range of the actuator to make these injections. But they can be done. It's within the range. So there's our injection signal. And of course, if you wanted to put something in through pCow, it would end up being seen in these channels, and we looked at them. And I should say that if you go and look through the references at the end, you'll find that there have been extensive searches of all of these auxiliary channels. So when I say we looked at all of them, we've really looked at all of them. So the same sort of plot for the event showing pCow shows that there was nothing present there. And again, the blue line, or the blue sort of hash, is our calibration lines, and the orange is the empty signal for the other photon calibrator, because nothing was happening at the time of the event. So a truly exhaustive search has been done of auxiliary channels to make sure that there was nothing which came in at any time. And let me kind of go through the logic of this. The check that I did through the DARM signal chain is looking at channels which should contain the gravitational wave signal. So they're hard to rule out just by looking for some transient. You expect a transient to appear in those channels at the time of the injection. So it's from the detector characterization point of view, they would be called unsafe channels. So you can think of the check that I did at looking at the DARM signal chain as a way of checking all of the unsafe channels to make sure they are what we expected them to be. And then there's the complementary set, which are all the safe channels. And these are all the things where DARM should not appear. And looking through all of the safe channels, all of the auxiliary channels, and making sure there's no transient in them allows you to rule out injections in places where DARM should not appear. Okay, so on to slide 23. So in addition to sort of the complexities of the system, we also have a lot of cross-checks. So not only would it be hard for someone to know what to do, we've gone through and looked and can say with fairly high confidence that really nothing strange was happening at the time of the event. I would add to this that we weren't really in a position to make these injections at the time of the event, in the sense that we didn't have the inverse filters present. And what that means is that if you want to push on one of the test masses with some sort of injection in a convincing way, you need to know what the coupling is from your actuator to the gravitational wave strain signal. And then whatever that coupling is, you should invert it. And that is what allows you to produce your signal. We didn't actually have the inverse filters for the photon calibrator or even for the ESD actuators at one of the sites ready at the time of the event. So the task is made somewhat even more daunting by the fact that we didn't really even know how to do this.
Okay, maybe before moving forward, let's see, there are a few questions. When there is a blind injection, it appears in all the channels like DARM?
Yeah, so blind injections appear everywhere that standard hardware injections appear, with the exception of the hardware injection channel itself. So they really come in through a parallel path. And that means if you're only looking at H of T, or if you're only looking at channels which are safe from the detector characterization point of view, you won't see a blind injection. However, as soon as you start looking at the DARM signal chain, blind injection looks like any other injection. So yeah, they're just like everything else and quite obvious.
Okay, then I think there was an objection on your previous slide when you were saying that the inverse actuators were not in place, but you have shown that such filters can be made.
I mean, so I think that at the time of the event, or the day before, I was working on the Livingston inverse actuation function, and I don't know if it was that day or the day after, but in any case,
the day before.
It was, yeah, the day before I was working on it. The day after, or a few days after it was installed, it didn't actually work. It had some stability problems, and then it took another couple of attempts before the guys at the site figured out things that I'd done wrong to get the filters working. So yeah, it can be done, and it was made to work, but it took a team effort to get it right. And And it's complicated by the actuation chain itself is difficult because it goes through multiple actuators and has steep roll-off filters which need to be inverted. So somehow the inverse actuation problem done with injections in the usual way is quite complicated. Now, one could fairly say that you know, you just inject somewhere else where the problem is less complicated, and that's fair. But to do that, in any case, you need to know, you know, the transfer functions of the electronics involved and the transfer functions of, you know, the sort of the physical transfer functions of the masses, which is the second part seems easy, but the suspensions are complicated objects. So it's, you know, even without some of the particular problems we had with this injection point, it's still a non-trivial thing. And the folks who are doing it kind of take for granted that we know the transfer functions of the electronics, but that really means getting down to the poles and zeros and resistors and capacitors in those things to figure out what's what. So I would say it's, you know, a non-trivial problem for an insider and difficult for me to imagine for an outsider.
Is it hopeless to pull an injection signal out of the car due to low SNR?
Yeah, I think CARM is worthless for all this stuff. The CARM signal is dominated by frequency noise, at least, and I don't think it gives us any real information. I suspect that you would need a motion large enough that it would unlock DARM before you could see anything in CARM. I'm not sure that we've tried, but I can't imagine that's useful. DARM is a very special channel in its sensitivity to differential strain. It's done that way intentionally. And everything else has to have a very large signal in order for it to couple into DARM from somewhere else. And the signal coupling from DARM to any other channel is small enough that you essentially never see it.
Okay, I think there was a question on Pical that Rick answered already. So why don't we move on? I think the next slide is about Pical anyway, so...
Yeah, Rick's answer is right. The one I'm plotting is the receive. There's also the transmit side, and then there's the digital record of what we sent out. All right, so slide 24, I wanted to give sort of a detailed example of how this might work for a particular attack. This attack was suggested by Al, who will otherwise remain nameless. And it's a combination of a double-blind injection and a frame spoof. So, as I said before, the appealing feature of PCAL is that it's relatively easy to invert. It has a clean transfer function, sort of flat transfer function, unlike the usual injection point through the ESD. And it also injects basically a force on the mass, which looks a lot like a gravitational wave. Would. And of course, that's why we like PCAL. It's a good way to calibrate the instrument. But it's also kind of an obvious target for injections. So the signal should appear, not only the injection, which would come through the digital system, would appear because we record everything which is injected, or these excitation points, as they're called. But it would also appear in a number of monitors. One, in terms of what goes out, and two, which are independent photodiode monitors of the PCAL. So this kind of easy hack would, first, we should remember that a lot of the people who work with the instrument don't actually know how to use the CBC codes. So I, for instance, don't know how to make a waveform for a binary black hole system, though I know people do, but you know, I have to go ask someone to make that for me. So that's easy for some people, but hard for others. You should somehow invert the coupling to generate the properly filtered waveform so that the strain you produce is right, which is different from the thing you have to put into PCAL in order to get that. Again, this requires, you know, some detailed knowledge of the hardware, not as much as other places, so PCAL is relatively easy. And then you're going to need to somehow get into a controlling machine to actually inject this signal. And if you're someone who works in the control room, maybe that's easy. Otherwise, it's pretty complicated. And the last thing you need to do is some sort of a frame spoof to cover up your tracks. Now, the tracks here are fewer in the sense that you only have three or four channels that you would need to overwrite. But you still need to find some way to overwrite them. And as we've seen, that's hard if you let it, you know, work its way down the chain. So probably you want to do it somewhere early. So on slide 25, I sort of want to capture all of these things. And if Rolf or Dave or Keith want to save me here, if I say something wrong, that would be great. But I think they've had a chance to look at these slides. I put all these things in what I call Easter egg hacks. So an Easter egg in software is something which is, you know, inside of some otherwise functioning piece of software, which behaves for a long time the way it's supposed to, and one day has a little surprise for you. And most of the kinds of things, since frame spoofing is so hard, you'd want to get to the data earlier. So most of the hacks we can imagine involve some sort of an Easter egg in the code. The analysis of the DARM signal chain rules out a bunch of those things if they're done in a sort of haphazard way. But if you're really careful and you can do whatever you want in the digital control system, you can always imagine some way to fake the signal. So let's go through what you would need to do to pull this off. The first thing is the same thing I mentioned before. You need to know how to make the signal, and you need to know how to deal with the actuator inversion process. So that's non-trivial. I think it probably rules out most of our CDS folks. The next thing you need to have is CDS administrator privileges at both observatories, and that rules out pretty much anyone who's not a CDS person, as well as in-depth knowledge of the CDS system itself to know exactly what you'd need to hack and how you'd need to hack it. And then probably the most challenging part is the one that Keith spoke to earlier, that right now, you know, people have closed loopholes and made sure that we know what was running at the time of the event. As far as we can tell, what was running was what was supposed to be running at the time, given the SVMs and uptimes. And then the last part of that loophole is to go through the code and make sure there's nothing tricky in there. I think that part of that's happening now, but again, relatively hard to imagine that some sophisticated piece of code has been hiding in our CDS system for a long time, waiting to dump in a signal. But that's the only kind of hack which seems to get around the problems of frame spoofing. Any questions on that?
I would suggest we move on to the next part, and then we see if there are more questions.
Okay, so I think with that, at least I'm fairly well convinced that but nothing has happened on the digital side, which is tricky. That is, nothing has been put into the data just because it would be so hard to pull it all off. I don't think that any one person in the collaboration is capable of doing it, and we would need probably a group of pretty knowledgeable folks. So that brings us to the last set of hacks, which are ones which say, okay, that's, if I go even as far as the digital system, things get too complicated. But the record of what happens in analog is much weaker. We don't have infinite disk space to store everything which happens everywhere in analog land. That's not the way things usually go. So one could imagine that if you had some way of generating a waveform and outputting it and just attaching it to one of our actuators in analog land after all the digital records have gone by, but you might be able to get signals in that no one would know about, just because they never were really part of the digital system until they appeared as a apparently gravitational wave signal. So this is the a couple of iPods and some clip leads hack. So our hacker here is someone who has access to the interferometer, and is going to try to use his iPod. I picked an iPod because it is in fact a programmable device which produces analog signals which you could take out of the earphone jack and imagine if it putting some clip leads on and clipping it onto something. And they make these in very small packages, so you could imagine doing this and hiding it somewhere. I wanted to go through this in a little more detail if you look at what would be required. The first thing that you would need if you wanted to do an analog hack is fairly free access to the VEAs at both sites, most likely the end stations. So you'd need to be able to get into the end stations and plant your iPod somewhere. Again, you would need some fairly in-depth knowledge of exactly how the interferometer works, really at the level of schematics of the electronics. if you wanted to know how to clip things in and make a believable injection. You have the usual inversion problem. You also need to be good at writing apps for some sort of mobile device. Maybe you're using a Teensy, or maybe you're using an iPod, maybe you're using, you know, your favorite phone. But you need something, you know, fairly sophisticated, because you want to have millisecond timing resolution between the observatories. I don't actually know how to do that. My guess is that probably someone does. There are wireless networks available at the sites, so maybe that could be done. And as usual, you'd need to know enough about gravitational waves to be able to produce a believable waveform. That already sounds sort of non-trivial. But there's a whole second layer to this game. So I'm on page 29. And that's that if you were to do this, you would need to have it well enough concealed that it wasn't discovered after the fact. So after the event, all the electronics racks were inspected and photographed. So we have some photographic record of what was present everywhere. Now, maybe it wouldn't have been at the level of finding something inside of the electronics. All of the card readers, so there are card readers that give you access to the VEAs, and the logs for those have been checked at both sites. If, at least at Hanford, the security is good enough that if you force a door or even use a key rather than a card, that entry is recorded. There might be some ways around this through emergency exits, but it would be tricky to do it at both sites. And the last sort of layer of security we have here, which I don't think we've used it to its fullest potential, is that we really have many sensors available, which are seismometers and microphones, in the VEAs. And we can, you know, if it comes down to it, we can actually go through all of those and look for human activity. So people wandering around show up on seismometers. Unless someone's really super stealthy, we're going to know that they went through one of the VEAs. At this point, I think the truth is we're convinced from the entry logs and the inspections that nothing funny had happened to the electronics during the time of the event.
So I believe that, sorry, those sensors are actually being checked.
A first check has been done by Brian O'Reilly. He didn't find anything interesting in them, and it's unclear how stealthy someone would have to be to get around it. So the last round of this would be to, you know, go and look inside the electronics, so particularly the ones which are most sensitive. So the picture I'm showing here is the driver which pushes, is the ESD driver, so it's the electrostatic drive, and that's what pushes on the test mask directly. It's the main actuator when we do hardware injections, if we're not using the PCAL. So we'll look at these things more carefully later. In the meantime, they've been taped off and sealed so that people don't get in there and to tamper with them between now and when we get a chance to look inside. We don't want to do it during the run just because we don't want to break anything. So here I wanted to give a detailed example. Again, I picked what I think the hardware experts identify as the weakest point. So if you're going to make an attack, where would you go? And I'll go through this example. So electrostatic drives, as I said, are the things we use to push on the test masses. If I were doing an injection, this would be the obvious target. Again, the reason for that is that the inverse process is, or the inverse calculation is relatively simple, and the actuator strength is good enough. You would be able to make the injection there. It turns out that there's a not obvious flaw that we discovered later, which is that our monitor points for the ESDs would not have picked up an injection of the event. So this is an unfortunate feature. We've looked as hard as we can, and they really are just not good enough. That will be fixed. But let's imagine that someone actually knew that ahead of time and was using that to their advantage for this obvious hack. So again, you would need to know how to program your iPod to do this, and you need to figure out the timing accuracy problem. You need something which is within a few milliseconds of write. You need to know how to produce the appropriate waveforms, you need to know how to do the time domain filtering, and you need to know that filtering is actually different between the sites. So the ESDs have different actuation functions at H1 and L1. This is really because at some point Rana changed some resistor, and he put it in the A-log. It was the right resistor to change, but it didn't happen in Hanford. So again, You need to know some pretty detailed information to get this right. But maybe you've done that. At that point, you're going to need to travel to both sites, get access to end stations at both sites. Probably, if you're one of the very few people who travel to both sites, we know who you are. If you're not one of those people, then you must have recruited some conspirators who are going to plant the devices for you. All right, that's already bad. Let's go to page 31, and this is the rest of what would be required for the sort of most obvious analog hack. You need to get your iPods inside of these devices, or else the inspection after the event would detect them. That means you probably need a few hours. You need to do it sometime when the interferometer is down so that you can pull the things out, unplug them, get them out of the rack, open them up, plant your device, clip lead it in somehow internally. Again, not obvious if you don't know what you're doing. But you can't actually use the test inputs. So in the picture at the top, I've circled the test inputs to this device. They're kind of sitting there looking like friendly places where you might just plug something into the BNC cable and inject a signal. If someone actually did that, which is kind of the most obvious thing to do, then they would have been found in the inspection. Basically because they can't get into the building to remove them without showing up in the logs. And if you left them there, they would be in the photographs. So you have to have anticipated this post-event search and put your thing inside of the drivers. If that's what happened, then someday soon we will discover that they're there. When we go and look inside of these things. But it seems pretty far-fetched as a way of making an injection. And again, it really requires a fairly significant internal conspiracy, and I think that's as high as we can put the bar. So this is the easiest analog hack I can think of. Someone had suggested earlier the idea of adding something on the light, and again, I think that's very hard. If you're adding something, after the signal has come in on the photodetectors in analog, again, that poses problems similar to this ESD hack, though, somewhat different, but similar sorts of problems.
Okay, there are a few questions. One is, can the entry logs be falsified?
Does Mike O'Brien want to speak to that?
Well, we haven't looked at that. The one thing we looked at was if the end stations were shut down, would they not be logged? But those logs are stored. So we're following up on that, Richard and myself, and we'll check on what it would take to hack the computer, which resides by the operator who's there 24/7. So I think that's a question we'll follow up on overall.
I guess Alan's question is, what about the side door that Rana always uses? I guess the point is, are the log doors the only access point?
So at the end stations, all doors are logged well. In the corner, there are some doors that are not logged. So that's a different story. You'd have to know which ones are logged and which ones are not, which was not understood until we made a test after, in the past couple of weeks. So the corner station, in some sense, is less secure than the end stations. So for an analog hack at the photodiodes, we're looking at trends of the DC PD chain to understand if you would see, say, a cable being disconnected and something being removed serially since the event. We're pretty close to finishing that analysis, where there was a test made of removing that cable yesterday, so we understand what the signal looks like.
So at Livingston, so one of the things that comes out of these investigations is that both sites have differences, so you wouldn't make a one size fits all plan. But our end station does have locked doors that don't alarm the Cantex system. At the corner station, it's not clear if you can get in the VEA through all the doors, it's a test we'll have to do. Even the people who run that system, which again is a standalone card access system, the machine sits by the operator, weren't sure what the status of every door in the VEA was, if they'd been alarmed or not. So you would, if you were to use those doors, you would, you know, I don't know how you would know without doing a test. You can get to the electronics rack at Livingston without doing a card access swipe in the corner station. Also at the end station with a key. But again, you'd have to defeat PEM sensors. And at Hanford, if you wanted to get to the corner electronics room, you would need a card access. So you'd have to do different things at each site.
Okay, some of the latest questions are related to the ITMs, ESDs. Are there ESDs for the ITMs in the corner station where those ESDs inputs are looked at? Could an injection have been performed there as easily as for an ETM?
So I think the question of easily or not is maybe one I can address, that we have one ITM actuator which is wired, and the actuation range is smaller. I don't know that we look to see if the actuation range is sufficient for the ITM actuator. And Brian, can you say whether or not that's been photographed? I guess the answer is yes. But
So we did inspect the ITM ESD here. We have one ITM where the ESD has been cut, because there was a problem with the initial ESD, so the solution was to flip the compensation plate, and that meant cutting the wires. So you'd have to know that you could only use ITMX. We've looked at that driver. Again, no weirdness there.
Okay, and I guess the situation in Hanford is that neither of those are actually operating. If that's not right, Mike, you can correct.
No, that's right, Matt.
Okay, Ray has a question. Ray is here,
it's
so why are you...
It's just another port, which I wonder if you're worried about. And that is the injection, if one wanted to do it, but at a much higher level, on the low-pass filters that are after the amplifiers to the ESD. Those were put in at both sides, but... And they could be a place where if you put in, instead of whatever it is, millivolts, you have to put in tens of volts, you could get an excitation into those.
So I think the box you're thinking of with some
resistors. They're in the cable trays. That's where they are, up at some altitude.
Have those not been replaced by this low-voltage driver box? I'm pretty sure they have.
So, I'm not sure of that.
Yeah, so this piece of hardware that's photographed was actually the replacement for that box, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, that's an important consideration. Is that true both of the bias line as well as...
Yes. Rich Abbott, where you are, or someone else who wants to confirm that the electronics actually have been consolidated from that box into this driver?
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that
that's okay.
That was a temporary thing which went away with a more official piece of electronics.
In any case, we also inspected the run from the ESD to the flange at each end station for the ESD to verify that there was nothing suspicious. So we could follow that cable in the cable tray. It's a fairly short run. And we could climb up and look at the flange. Stuart Aston and I did that here at Livingston.
Right, okay, good. And we have some confirmation that I was right about that temporary electronics went away. So. Oh, sorry, but the resistor box is still in place, right? So the bias line. Okay, anyway, Richard has put it in the chat there.
Wait, there is still a box up there you can get into.
Which was inspected, yeah.
Which was inspected.
Yeah, it was inspected.
Yeah. Okay, I apologize if I missed anything. So there was a discussion if a phone would have a GPS good enough for synchronizing.
Yeah, it's a question I've asked myself. I don't have an answer for whether or not you can get millisecond timing on your iPhone. I guess you would need to do something special to do it, but I don't know exactly what it is. like everything, someone must have written an app for that. I don't know of it.
Milliseconds timing is fairly easy with GPS and modern CPU.
Yeah. Thank you, Vladimir. Other questions I should get to here?
I would say we move on. I think we are almost at the end.
So let me just finish this off. So I think the analog hacks, we can rule them out in the sense that again, you would need to have some sort of internal conspiracy to pull this off. And I don't think it's that you can easily imagine any way to pull off an analog hack that doesn't require at least a few people, probably a few people at each site. And that restricts the number of people available significantly, and also limits you to people who have good motivation to not do such a thing.
So there are other questions now related. How about mechanical injections, acoustic? Mike is answering that the monitoring system, TEM system, is...
Yeah, right. So there are many kinds of injections which I didn't talk about here, which are things which you can imagine, I want to say environmental injection, something loud or some large motion or a big magnetic field or something like that might inject a signal into the interferometers. These are tricky for a couple of reasons. One of them is it's usually really tricky to invert the actuation function because we've done the best job we can of isolating ourselves from all of these things. But let's ignore that for the moment. It's also tricky because we also monitor all of those things with our PEM system. So these things, once again, have been looked at in great detail to see if there's anything interesting in any of the PEM monitors, this physical environment monitoring system, anything in the PEM system at the time of the event, and there's nothing interesting in there.
So Vicky just asked, when Big Dog was injected, how many people were actually involved?
I think relatively few, but that's the kind of thing which went through the hardware injection mechanism. The Big Dog event was injected as a blind injection, but a blind injection is just a hardware injection done through a channel that you're not supposed to look at. So in the analysis that I've done, I'm not the only person who's done it, this has been repeated by a few others, any sort of injection, including the one for the Big Dog, would have appeared there immediately. Actually, to tell the truth, the Big Dog would have been discovered first by Jeff Kissel, who asked if he could break the rules, was told that he could, broke the rules, and looked at the blind injection channel and saw that there was nothing there.
No, hey, Matt. Did
I get that wrong?
Can I comment on that?
Yes, please.
So that's certainly... for this event, we did not break the rules. We were not under a blind injection phase. So I was a blind injector for the Big Dog event. And for blind injections, we didn't want to surprise the collaboration. There was not supposed to be any sort of double blind scenario. So we were either in a blind injection phase or we were not. So when we had this candidate on set 14, I went to the blind injection team to ask them if they were in a blind injection phase and did not alert the collaboration. And they said, no, absolutely not. And I checked with Gabby on that too. So that the point is that it was fair to look at these blind injection channels at the time.
Sorry, so I said that not very carefully. What I meant is that he looked at the blind injection channel, which normally, if we were in a blind injection phase, would have been breaking the rules. At the time, which Jeff confirmed was not in fact breaking the rules, and so we checked. Something which otherwise would have allowed a blind injection to be blind. Was not in place at the time. So anyway, let's just say there's nothing special about blind injections, and we would have found it six ways from Sunday by now.
And maybe we can add that the word blind is a little bit misleading. It's not like it's really blind in the sense that it doesn't leave a trace in the signal anyway.
It's blind if you play by the rules, which right. Everyone should.
Right.
Other questions? Should we get to in here? Okay, so let me go through the conclusion, and then I can answer any remaining questions. I think that the thing that I took away from this study was really me investigating in the end the work that a lot of people have done to make sure that there was nothing malicious happening at the time of the event. The message I took away is that at first blush, something might seem like an easy hack. And yet when you dig into what's really required to do any of the hacks that come to mind, you discover that they're quite challenging. And usually you find not only that it's challenging in terms of what would need to be done, it's challenging to know what would need to be done. And you usually find that there's somebody, usually at the observatories, who has spent a great deal of time making sure that whatever hack you're thinking of is in fact not possible. So people have been looking very carefully. A couple of the questions I got when I asked for questions relevant to this talk sort of implied that people thought that somehow the idea of injection had been dismissed and that no one was really taking it seriously. And I'd very much like to dispel that. The thing that I learned in putting together this talk is that there are a lot of people who took this very seriously, and everything I could come up with had been checked by a few people before I got to it. So I would say this has been taken very seriously and been done very carefully. And while I'm not the most knowledgeable person about anything but the one little piece that I did, there are people who are knowledgeable about all of these things. And if you go to the reference page, the one after the conclusion, you'll find that there's a large number of log entries and documents which have been produced which detail exactly why none of these hacks work. So the last statement is I think the only conclusion we can give, which is that we can't say that faking the event was impossible. But we can say that if you wanted to fake it, you would probably need to get a fairly large group of insiders to conspire to make this. And that's probably as high as you can put the bar in any sort of scientific endeavor.
I guess Chad commented earlier that maybe like only 6 people would be needed.
Yeah, I consider more than 3. More than 2 is already a large number. If you say the chance, so we're not talking about everyone on the planet. We're talking about people who are insiders, people who really know the system well. And that gets you a relatively small number of people. And then the idea that you have more than one of the inside folks who's decided that it would be profitable somehow to do this strikes me as a very remote possibility. Other questions?
Leo is asking what would be the reason to do this, but I guess maybe...
This is actually a good question, and one that Abe Singer, our computer security guy, pointed out to me in an email exchange I had with him, was that one of the first things you do when thinking about crimes of whatever sort is what's the motivation. And it's hard to imagine that the people capable of doing this would have any significant motivation for doing it. So on the motivation side, I haven't really spoken to that at all in this talk, but it's a perfectly legitimate question and one for which I don't think we really have an answer. So I wanted to end with just sort of a comment which I wrote at the top, which is that I've spent a little bit of time contemplating the initial objection, which is the signal is too perfect, so we must have made it ourselves. And I think that there's some flaw in that logic really outright. All of the injections we made before the event were wrong. I mean, if anyone thinks about the line injection of the big dog, I think that the conclusion was the signal was not really injected properly. And our track record for making these kinds of injections is not great. Now we're getting better, and people are working on it. But at the time of the event, we really didn't know how to do this properly. The second part of that is kind of the flip side. If it didn't look like something predicted by GR, wouldn't we be more suspicious? Right? If it had something that was obviously glitchy or kind of had the signs of an injection, I think we would need to be more suspicious than we are right now. So the perfection of the signal is somehow what you would expect. GR is so far usually right. All right, I'll leave it there and answer any remaining questions.
Yeah, it's almost 1.5 hours now. Is there any other question or comment that people would like to make at this point? Yeah, I think the comment is that it would be good to have another event. Yes, I think we can all agree on that. Okay. I guess we are.
And I want to thank Matt for doing this. Thank
you. Yeah, I mean, I should. You know, I see people saying thanks in the chat. Let me really just say thanks to everyone who's done these investigations. I did one little small piece of it, and a lot of people have poured a significant amount of time into the work that I'm presenting here. So again, there are many references in the next slide.
Yeah, maybe you wanted to keep the
I'll show here. And this represents, I don't know how many man weeks or man months of time, most of which is not mine. So thanks to everybody for taking this seriously.
Okay, yeah, start Mike, please.
So I have a question. This is a lot of stuff that in some cases was harder than it really should be. Are we capturing enough of this that the next investigation of this type can be quicker, more airtight, and more confident?
Yeah, so the documents I've looked through certainly have a lessons learned section in them. I don't know if Mike, Brian, Rolf, anyone out there wants to add to that, but I've seen the lessons learned is one of the important parts of what we're doing here. So what can we do to make this process easier? And even the improbable hacks, the ones that we see are relatively easy to make even less probable, that's happening as well.
Okay, so I want to make sure that that's at least rolled into the post-run commissioning plan to implement those.
Yes.
Mike and Brian are coordinating this.
All right, thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you. Thank you again. Bye, everyone.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Matt.